So nice to have you back, Larry, on this podcast.
Good to be with you, Neiman.
Yeah. Let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. We've learned that the U.S. commander of CENTCOM is in Israel. And in your opinion, and Israel is so desperate to pick a fight with Hezbollah again. And what's your take on this visit?
What you just said right off the bat is one of the major changes we made, we the United States, the American Empire, that Colin Powell and others in the military were dead set against. The first was creating Africa Command, which we did after Powell left the chairmanship, but he was dead against that. He said, we'll militarize policy in North Africa and the Middle East. That's exactly what we did. And they started kicking us out because we'd done that. The other thing he was against was switching Israel from European command into Central Command, because it put Israel in with 300 plus million Arabs. And he thought that was an untenable situation. It was better for them to be geographically miscast, if you will, and be in European command than to be with all the Arabs in Central Command. Well, we changed that. And so this visit by the commander-in-chief of Central Command to Israel is indicative of the stupidity of that move. Just putting him there is another major act of hypocrisy. We are saying again, we are with you through thick and thin, and here's our most powerful combatant commander visiting you with whatever you wish in his hands. That's what we're saying. Now, he may be there to counsel. He may be there to give some advice, but he's not the person who should be doing it. It should be the Secretary of State and perhaps the Secretary of Defense, but both of them are quislings. They are quislings. They are disciples of Bibi Netanyahu. If you listen to Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, C.Q. Brown, the other day in the NATO briefing session, you understand that they are doing nothing but parroting their president's views. There is no selection. There is no attempt to avoid the gross hypocrisy on Ukraine or on Gaza. And this is debilitating. It's taking the empire down a notch at a time almost every week. I just got a note from a friend of mine in Sri Lanka. The other day, I got one from a friend of mine in Taipei. What's wrong with the empire? They use that term now. What's wrong with the empire? The empire is looking very bad. Do you realize what China is doing to you in its Belt Road Initiative, its Silk Road Initiative, however we want to term it? Do you understand what they're doing? They're using soft power from one end of the globe to the other end to recruit allies and friends, to change the currency mode in the world. They are doing what China wants to do and doing it well and thoroughly because you are so absent from the scene except for your hypocrisy and your misuse of power. In 2 years of war, they're killing people. China's not killing anybody anywhere. China's not doing anything like this. China is beating you from one end of the globe to the other, and they're not firing a shot. This is not good for the empire. Now, that's the kind of message I'm getting, and that's the kind of message I'm hearing from sane people all over the world, whether they be American citizens abroad or they be people I know from other countries who are our friends, supposedly. It's very disturbing. It's especially disturbing to hear them talk about how can we do what we're doing in support of Israel. That's the big question on many people's minds across the globe. How can the United States do what it's doing in support of this? And let's face it, John Mearsheimer's right, and the Lancet magazine is right. There's not 40,000 Palestinians lying dead in Gaza. There's at least 150,000 lying dead. And I think John's right, is probably north of 200,000. When we get through, all you have to do is take the U.S. Army's battlefield patterning. You look at the munitions drop, you look at the type of terrain, you look at the frequency and density of the munitions, you look at the people, you look at the constraints in the terrain, you map the terrain, and you can predict the casualties. The cost of war project at Brown University has done this exquisitely. They did it in Libya, for example. you can count the casualties before you even move the debris within 1 or 2% of what it's going to be when you do move the debris. And usually when your mistakes occur, small though they are, they occur on the downside. In other words, they're higher. So you're looking at probably 150,000, 200,000 people dead, many of whom will probably never be found because it's so deeply buried under the rubble and the debris. And you're looking at a situation that is utterly unconscionable in 4 to 5 billion people's minds and eyes in this world. And they're watching us support it, and not just support it, but lie about it from day to day to day to day. And saying things like Putin should have been apprehended when he traveled. He's a war criminal. Bibi Netanyahu came to the United States of America, a supposed supporter of international law and international humanitarian law in particular. He came to the United States and addressed the Congress to standing ovations. We didn't arrest him. We cheered him. We are the biggest hypocrites in the world, Nima, and it's beginning to gnaw at our real power in the world, because a lot of our power was reputational. People might have hated us from time to time, but they did believe that basically we stood for human rights. We stood for democracy. That's another part of the hypocrisy, that we're talking about democracy and rejuvenating liberal democracy in the world. Hell, we're not a liberal democracy. We're an oligarchy. And the oligarchy has been on war and more war. So we're really losing in the world. We're losing badly. And we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for it dearly.
Larry, do you think that the Netanyahu administration is feeling that the United States is leaving the region? And one of the reasons of this visit was that? That's why they start talking about attacking Hezbollah again, or it's something else?
You know, that's been in the back of my mind for some time. I don't think Netanyahu has got that in his mind as a principal thought, but it's got to be somewhere in there that there was an inclination on the part of the Arabs, at least, and that probably transferred to a certain extent to Jerusalem, that the United States was leaving in order to shift to China. You talked about it, pivot to China. We gave it all kinds of names and then got buried in Ukraine and Gaza. But the real, everyone in the military, in the U.S. military, understands that China presents the greatest security threat to the empire. They also understand, I think, from my conversations with some of them who are smarter than the leadership, the colonels and the lieutenant colonels and the majors, they also understand that China does not want a war. They do not want a hot war. And they understand that if leadership is good and careful and diplomacy is exercised artfully, we can prevent a war. But at the same time, they also realize that the United States is looking as if it is at best a co-equal in this struggle right now, and maybe even sinking, and in the next decade or two to sink even lower to a lesser status. That is to say, China will be preeminent economically, militarily, and otherwise, technologically even. Certainly industrial base-wise, they are already surpassed us because they can build ships and airplanes much faster than we can. So in terms of the implements of war, they've already surpassed us, which worries me, as I said in the piece I did on for the Schiller Institute on nuclear weapons, that we'll be the ones to use the nuclear weapons because we'll lose in a conventional struggle. But these military officers understand that we need a different way. We need a different strategy, a different foreign policy if we're going to deal with China correctly. And we need to get beyond these little things. They're not little things in terms of the Palestinian deaths or in terms of Ukrainian deaths or, for that matter, Russian deaths. But compared to the empire's real threat out there, economic, military, security-wise, you name it, they are diversions. And they're serious diversions. And the hypocrisy of the diversions is, as I said, eating away at the last vestige of part of our real power, which is our reputation. The torture program in the Bush administration did a lot to that. I can remember Colin Powell coming back a number of times and saying, I don't mention human rights to my counterpart in Beijing anymore because I feel stupid. I feel stupid talking about human rights when we just revealed Abu Ghraib. It's crazy. Go out and do a press conference with the Indian foreign minister, and he gets no questions for the Indian foreign minister or about India-U.S. relations, but he gets questions about Abu Ghraib because it had just broken. That's the kind of damage these things do to our reputation, and our reputation is real power for us. So it's a difficult time, and I don't – here's the crutch. I don't see either of these candidates doing anything but deepening it, not changing it. It's another 4 years we've got to wait, minimum, another 4 years for someone to come along and set the empire on a better path.
Yeah. And right now, do you think that Israelis are talking about sending those people from the northern part of Israel to their homes? In your opinion, with the current situation in Gaza and the tensions, the escalation that is happening right now between Israel and Hezbollah, are they going to be able to send these people to their homes in the northern part of Israel? Or they have to stop their just attacking Gaza, and then maybe they may have that would be possible to do that.
That's an excellent tactical question. I've been listening to Hassan Nasrallah, and I've been listening to those that have some way to listen to them in Iran. And I've been talking to other people who've been in Iran, and I've been talking to people who have been in Baghdad and looking at what we were doing with Baghdad, for example, the agreement we just made with them. Bad agreement. The prime minister there should never have let us stay, should have stuck to his guns, he should have told us to leave. And to say in the agreement that one of the reasons we're staying, and the prime minister of Iraq actually said that we can handle what's left of ISIS. And I have no doubt that they can. But he also said, at least that's what I'm told he said, I didn't hear him, but he also said that the United States was staying with a few troops in order to have a presence next to Iran. And that worries him a little bit because he's got to deal with Iran, and he's not really all that happy about what Iran is doing in Iraq. And he's got to deal with the United States too, and he's not really happy about how that might exacerbate what Iran is doing in Iraq. So he copped out and he let us stay for God knows how long. But and then on the other hand, look over in Syria where we, Gary Vogler, I may have talked to you before about Gary. Gary was 78 months in Iraq. He's a former oil man for a number of different private companies. We picked him and made him number two and sent him to Iraq during the war there, 2003 to 2011. He was there for 78 months. And the guy who was over him finally came into him one day and said, I'm leaving. I'm out of here. I'm not working with these guys. I'm out of here. And left. So Gary became the principal U.S. person in Iraq, dealing with the oil ministry and trying to get this oil ministry and the oil program back up on its feet and pumping. Incidentally, you know who the biggest benefactor of the Iraq war in terms of oil is? China. China's getting more oil for Iraq than ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, Total, BP, any other company. China's getting the oil. But we created this little enclave in Syria where Israel could get oil at a discounted price. That's why our forces are in Israel, protecting that facility. Now, I just understood that I haven't confirmed this. They won't talk to me about it in the Pentagon. I just heard that with Russian backing, Bashar al-Assad's mainline forces moved on that installation and they forced us off of it. So I'm waiting to see what happens with that couple of hundred or 2,000, whatever it is now, troops that we have in Syria illegally against international law. We're not asked to be there by the recognized government in Syria. So we're there illegally. And Gary calls it this. Gary calls it the biggest crooked criminal oil operation in the world today. And he looked at the UN Oil for Food program when Mark Rich was shipping discounted oil to Israel and finally got put in jail for it because he was stealing the oil or buying the oil, breaking sanctions, U.S. sanctions under the UN Oil for Food program in Iraq and shipping it to Israel. So this is just a long running story of how we support criminals and criminal activity. And even now use our Marines and soldiers to protect that criminal activity. Remember Smedley Butler, who said he was a criminal on two continents for capitalism, Marine two-star general? Well, he was right. That's what we're doing in Syria. This is a situation that if we pull out, to get back to your question, if we pull out completely, which I think we would like to do and go back to offshore balancing as we did for 40 some odd years, then yes, that force presence is gone. And all these things will probably be taken over by those people who own the country and the territory, and including Iraq. And so it's got to be in the back of Bibi's mind that we could leave the region. And though we will say that there's no de-emphasis attended on Israel, there will be de-emphasis because we only have so many troops.
Yeah.
Now, that assumes Israel is going to continue to exist. You will not get me to say that Israel is going to be a state much longer. And it is certainly, I'll commit to this 100% across the board, it will not be a liberal democracy, and it will not be a Jewish state. If it's a liberal democracy, it won't be a Jewish state because the population dictates against that. If it's an apartheid state, it's not a democracy. It can be a Jewish state if it's an apartheid state, but if it's a Jewish state and an apartheid state, more of the same will happen to it repeatedly and with greater frequency as is happening to it right now. Can't live that way. Can't live that way. The Jews that went there for a safe haven, they don't have a safe haven anymore. This is the longest war Israel's ever fought. And this is the future for Israel if they don't change.
Do you think that this type, the point that you have, you just brought up, that in your opinion, these Jews, Brooklyn Jews in Israel, talking about the American Jews in Israel, liberal, do they understand the point that you've mentioned?
Some of them do, because I've talked with a few, and some of them do. I'm still alarmed greatly by the fact that polls yesterday I saw show 42% of the Israeli Jewish population living in Israel believes Netanyahu is doing the right thing. They don't like Netanyahu. They hate his guts. By an overwhelming margin, they hate his guts because they think he's doing it for his own personal reasons to stay out of jail. And they're really angry with him over the hostages because they think that's why he's doing it, to stay out of jail. And if he brings a ceasefire and gets the hostages back, things might slow down and they might have enough time to investigate what happened on October the 7th. And that would just add to his problems. Have you heard about the movie? The movie that opened at the Toronto Film Festival? Bibi? What's the name of it? The Bibi Files. You know, they have some kind of weird law in Israel. And he's been successful. He tried ardently and voraciously to keep it from being shown anywhere. They have a weird law in Israel that says if you video working government officials, you're prohibited from showing the video in Israel. So they can't show the film. You got to believe Bibi was behind that law. But they've shown it in Canada, and they're going to show it elsewhere. And the filmmaker, the producer, and the director are old acquaintances, especially Alex Gibney. Alex Gibney, the producer, made Taxi to the Dark Side, the murder of Dilawar in Afghanistan. We murdered him. In interrogating him, we murdered him. And Alex made a great documentary about it. I won't say great. That's not the right adjective. He made a documentary that showed exactly what happened. And he's done some other good movies, too. But at the end of that showing in Toronto, in the piece in The Guardian that I was reading, which I assume is fairly accurate, one of the people who clearly was, I won't say a Jew, but he was certainly, assume he was, but certainly an Israeli ardent fan, he asked at the end how he came up with the number of 40,000 Palestinians dead. And, you know, go back to what John Mearsheimer said, and I just reaffirmed, it's probably 200,000 and north of that. And this is what you get. And I think it was the producer or the director, Alexis Bloom, who came back and said, well, you know, that's what people say. And the guy said, oh, you fabricated that. You fabricated that. This is what I encounter every other Sunday when we do simulations on the IPC, the Israeli-Palestinian Confederation, because we have everything, everyone in this simulation for a couple of hours every other Sunday. They're Palestinians, they're Israelis, there are others from all across the world. There are Knesset members, there are former Knesset members. And we have these vicious arguments sometimes back and forth, and people won't believe people. No matter how real, no matter how credible the facts are, they won't believe people because Bibi can't be that bad. Israel can't be doing that. The films of the torture taking place in Israeli prisons, and this isn't just now. This is back years that this has been going on. And the films are there. They're like Abu Ghraib plus, Abu Ghraib times 10. And people don't believe them. They don't believe their own eyes when they see these films. No, no, we couldn't be doing that. We're not doing that. No, we don't. Or on the other hand, they say, should do it more. Should do more of it. Get some more of them and put them in there and do it to them too. Rape them. Rape 7 or 8 at a time. Can't you rape more? I mean, this is the kind of dichotomy you get. And I think the reality of that dichotomy is hitting some people in the face, both in Israel and outside, in this country in particular, that this isn't the great safe haven for Jews in the world that everyone thought it was. That it is, in fact, turned into the very thing that caused them to create it in the first place, the Nazis, the Holocaust. That they are the perpetrators of the same kind of life for the Palestinians as was perpetrated on them in the 30s and 40s in Europe by Hitler. That's dawning on some people in this country and in Israel.
Larry, we've learned before coming to this podcast, before starting this podcast, I've learned that the Syrian government, they're talking about, they have shot down in an Israeli F-16. And if they did that, that would be hugely a Russian policy that is changing in that region. Because before, the Russia was so cautious about this interaction between Syrians and Israelis. Right now, it doesn't seem to be that cautious in their behavior. Do you think that Russia is just changing their policy, Russians are changing their policy in the Middle East?
I think it's unquestionable they are. But let me back up for a second and just say I've had so much debate of late about F-16s. There are lots of F-16s. There are F-16s that aren't credible to be in the air because they haven't been modified and they haven't been brought up to speed. I think it was first fielded in 78. Think about that for a minute. 78, that's a long time ago. Now, the best ones, of course, are owned by us and our closest allies, and they're pretty good airplanes. But even so, there's this phenomenon with the F-16, and I suspect Ukraine's already found out about this. No doubt we told them, but I suspect you've got to find out on your own. The F-16 will kill you. The airplane, will kill you. If you think you're a really hotshot pilot, good, great pilot, it'll kill you quicker. Because you don't fly the F-16, the F-16 flies itself. And if you try to interfere in a particularly high G turn or something like that, if you try to interfere with that airplane trying to fly itself, it will kill you. And so it's a very unique airplane. But to your question, I think Putin is moving in ways that are probably very inimical to our interest in a number of places. And he's doing so because he's convinced, and Ukraine has convinced him, and he said this a number of times, that we are duplicitous, that we lie, we cheat, we steal, we have a foreign policy that is inimical totally to Russia. We have changed everything we said in the 90s when we ended the Cold War and George W. Bush, H.W. Bush said, we're not going to beat our chest, into beating our chest feverishly and wanting to eliminate Russia from the scene, and particularly eliminate Putin. So he's moving. He's in Vietnam. He's in Indonesia. He's in Malaysia. He's in where we were supposed to catch him as a war criminal, Mongolia. What hypocrisy that is. We let a war criminal of a much greater stature come to our Congress, and we talk about addressing Putin in Mongolia as a war criminal. I mean, the hypocrisy just reeks. It flows from our ears every time Blinken or anyone gets up to speak. But Putin is convinced. I think he's convinced he's going to have to fight NATO someday. And whether that's true or not is irrelevant because he's convinced of it. And so he's setting things up to do that. Now, I heard a week ago from a friend who, remember Ambassador Matlock on the show? Well, there was an individual who used to work for Matlock, and he's an economist. And he told me that they're looking at some really grievous statistics, was what he said, for 2025, late in 2025 and 2026. Economic-wise. I don't know what those can be, and I'm waiting for some information, some specifics on it. But from my perspective, it seems like his economy is doing pretty well, and if he can devote the percentage of GDP that he's devoting to the war right now, I don't see how it could be doing that poorly. However, I do understand that there are a lot of people out there thinking there's going to be a crash, and the crash is going to be indicated very vividly in the oil markets. And if that were to happen, then he'd probably take a real blow. So that might be some sort of impetus if he's getting those kinds of briefings from his economic counselors. Now his DOD guy, his Secretary of Defense, is an economic guy. If he's getting those kind of indications, then he's probably going to want to shut this down faster rather than slower. And I think probably the same thing goes for casualties and such, because he's been taking a lot of casualties too. And then you come to us. We're not going to move on this situation, I don't think, until after the elections. That's a lot of water under the bridge. All the way, and when I say after the elections, I don't even mean after November. I mean after the installation of the new president, whomever that might be. I think we're going to wait until then. A lot can happen in that time. A lot of Ukrainians die. Zelensky can be removed from office. I'd say there's a 60-40 chance Zelensky will be removed from office. Either the Ukrainians will insist on elections and vote him out, or more likely they'll throw him out, maybe kill him. And then they'll either have elections or they'll establish a military dictatorship. Then my question is, do they go on their own without Washington's approval or backing to negotiations with Putin? And if so, where? And, you know, what's the venue and what's the scope of the negotiations? How does the ceasefire take place? I know Putin's ready. I'm convinced Putin's ready. Sergey Lavrov and Putin have convinced me that they're ready to talk. Can Ukraine do it without the rest of its backing, particularly Washington? And would the Europeans do it? I don't know. Germany and France are new items on the block now after these elections, and I suspect there are going to be more like that. Would Ukraine attempt it without the United States and with Zelensky gone? Because the real connection to the United States, other than the oligarchs who are raking in money and bribes and everything else, just like Ukrainians always do, and I should say just like Americans always do, other than that, Zelensky's the real contact. He's the one that stands in Congress and has Lindsey Graham shake his hand and say, "We will come to your country and buy all that stuff you got there that we need so bad, and we'll pay you for it and everything." You see that interview? God, man, Lindsey Graham makes me sick. But that is a reality that he is probably the link. So if he's gone, could Ukraine on its own develop a negotiating position and meet with the Russians and bring this thing to a close? I'd cheer for 24 hours straight if they were competent enough to do that. And they put somebody in there through genuine elections that did it. That'd be a volte-face that would be a slap in the face of Washington, a slap in the face of its Lickspittle vassal in London, and a slap in the face of any other European that's still on this train of war. I think they're going to abandon it pretty fast now. I would predict by the end of 2025, maybe even by the middle of 2025, John Mearsheimer thinks the war is going to go on until after the elections. I don't see that. I understand why John says that, But I just see the pressures in Ukraine as being so great that they're going to have to get rid of Zelensky. He's not legal. He's not constitutional, we would say. He's not elected. He's just there. And if you release the military law, which the martial law, which you would do before negotiations, I would think, it, just as a sign to the Russians that you're serious, then he is totally illegitimate. He's not supposed to be there. You better have elections immediately and put somebody in there. So a lot of wickets to cross here, but I would love to see by Christmas Ukraine on its own negotiating with the Russians and bringing this to a close and proving to people like Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton and all those other idiots like Joe Biden even, that Putin has no interest whatsoever in any other NATO country.
Yeah. And Zelensky is just asking for more weapons, Larry, for more aid. Here comes the answer. Here comes the take of Lloyd Austin. He's talking about Zelensky. Look at this. Just...
Well, thanks, Phil. I did get a chance to spend some quality time with President Zelensky. And you'll recall that President Zelensky outlined his goals and objectives during his opening comments. And I would point you to that to, if you have questions about specific objectives. But in terms of the plan for victory, Phil, we didn't discuss that. We talked about a number of things, but that in that specific piece we didn't discuss, and President Zelensky is going to present that to President Biden and other leaders at the first opportunity. In terms of whether or not victory is achievable, again, I think this war could end very quickly if Mr. Putin decided to pull his forces out of the places that he's occupied in Ukraine. I mean, this was started by Putin. It could end, Putin could end it very quickly if he just made the simple and right decision to undo what he's done. In terms of absolute victory, it really depends on how you define that. Ukraine is focused on defending its sovereign territory. We're going to continue to do everything we can to help them do that. What Russia's goals and objectives are, I could speak to that specifically, and victory would be defined by goals and objectives. But we know from the very beginning that he's wanted to annex Ukraine because he doesn't believe that Ukraine is a bona fide country. I think eventually this conflict will be decided at a resolved at a negotiation table.
But
I can only come to one of two conclusions. Lloyd Austin is a quisling, a sycophant, a spokesperson for his president, and that makes him a really reprehensible individual because that means that he understands he's lying. Or the other possibility is he's not lying, he's telling the truth, and he's an idiot. I mean, I don't have any other choice. Listen to what he said. Now, he did stay away from Zelensky presented his victory proposal. He did stay away from that. He sort of minced words around that. He will save that for the president. Well, okay, we want to hear that, Mr. Zelensky, because it's militarily infeasible that you should have such a proposal. You cannot achieve victory. There is no way on God's green earth you're going to achieve victory. Now, listen to the other lies he told, though. Putin didn't start this war. We started this war. We had ample opportunity at multiple moments to stop this progression towards the invasion that ultimately occurred. We knew the invasion was coming. We knew that Ukraine would be a cash basket, a cash cow, for a while at least. We knew that we could bleed Russia through this proxy apparatus. I'm not even sure that we ever thought that there was a possibility Ukraine would achieve victory. Now, stupid people like Tom Cotton and Lindsey Graham did, but not real people in the Pentagon who think about these things in a legitimate and logical way. Lloyd Austin should be one of them, but I'm increasingly convinced he's not. So he's lying. He's either lying or he's an idiot. I don't have any other choice about characterizing him. And that's really bothersome. It's bothersome that he's a general. He's a general in mufti standing there talking as if he were a civilian, as if he were constitutional in that regard. He shouldn't even be the Secretary of Defense. We only have one civilian. We have one civilian in the chain of command, and he's demented. He's significantly demented. I'm convinced of that. So this is a dangerous period in many respects, and we should never have let it come about. But we did, and so the ultimate responsible entity here is the American people. We have not been tending our republic worth a damn. And that's a perfect example of it. I listened to him and C.Q. Brown, as I told you, and I had every hope, because a very good friend of mine is a close acquaintance of C.Q. Brown, General C.Q. Brown, who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. All I heard was echoes of Lloyd Austin from C.Q. Brown. Now, go back to Milley. Go back to Chairman Milley, for whom I had little real respect until he stood up to Trump after the Bible incident at the church and had the courage to send out a telegram to officers across the army saying he'd made a mistake. He should never have been there at Lafayette Square, never have been there. Violation of everything our Constitution stands for, to be there supporting that president at that moment. Brave man. And subsequently, he proved that he had even deeper courage than perhaps I thought. So I was wrong about Milley. Austin and C.Q. Brown are no Milley. And that really troubles me, because we're coming up on the possibility of this man, Donald Trump, coming back into the White House. Debates are tonight, I think, and the polls are pretty level right now. That would, in my view, be a disaster. I'm not sure I really want either one of them to win. I wish there were a third candidate out there somewhere with some viability. There is Jill Stein, of course, but she doesn't have a chance of winning. But, you know, as I said before, I look around for something to be hopeful and optimistic about, and I find nothing. Not on the security and foreign policy scene, I find nothing. I find no one, and I find nothing. Very discouraging. We're getting by, Nima, right now on residual power, economic, military, and otherwise, that's still lying around for people to pick up and throw at other people. Once that tiny little bit of residual power is eroded away, we won't have anything. And that's when the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and everybody else in the world will clap with glee and march over our grave.
What's so amazing, Larry, about what Lloyd Austin said is he's asking Putin just to withdraw all the Russian troops from the eastern part of Ukraine after more than 2 years.
And the idea that Putin would have wanted all of Ukraine to govern, he'd have had a guerrilla war for the rest of his natural life, and so would two leaders after him. I mean, it's just such nonsense. These people are thinking in a historical prison that comes from years and years ago and comes from their minor experiences in most cases, because they weren't Cold War warriors in a lot of cases, in the Cold War. They can't get out of that syndrome. They can't get out of that mindset. The person, I had this debate with a gentleman the other day. The person who ended the Cold War was Mikhail Gorbachev. That's who ended the Cold War. And he changed the entire fabric of 70 plus years of Lenin's and Stalin's, more importantly, experiment. And to a certain extent, Yeltsin screwed it. He totally screwed it. And along came Putin and saw that it was screwed and put it back together as best he could in a very, shall we say, Russian style, czar style, if you will. But he put it back together. And we can't handle that. We just can't handle that. We can't live with that. We've got to bring Putin down. Any way, fashion, or form we can do it, we've got to bring him down. I'm surprised we haven't planted the CIA in Lubyanka prison, executed everybody in there, taken it over, and started this clandestine operation out of the place, or the basement or something. It's just probably because our best diplomat, the head of the CIA, is too busy in Gaza, too busy in Doha, Cairo, and every place else. He's the only diplomat we have, and he's showing it because he's the one dealing with all this. Blinken should be ashamed of himself. He should be utterly ashamed of himself that all he does is hold Bibi's hand and stroke Bibi's neck and stroke his back and keep him content and happy and give him all he wants, while his CIA director conducts American foreign policy. Biden should be ashamed too. But Bill's got a hard job. I don't demean him for trying to do it, but he is the only one that is a diplomat in the entire administration.
Larry, Victoria Nuland recently had an interview in which she was talking about why they have decided not to negotiate with Russia. And let's look at it.
I couldn't help but when I was watching First her, I told couldn't help. Before. God, are you ugly.
There was a story told by former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett that both sides were really close to the end, to the successful end of the negotiations. And then Prime Minister Boris Johnson interfered and stopped prevented Ukrainians from signing the deal. And then Ukrainian Representative Arahami kind of confirmed it, that yes, he said in an interview that there was some kind of advice from Boris Johnson to stop negotiating and to win this war militarily. Where is the myth? Where is the truth?
Relatively late in the game, the Ukrainians began asking for advice on where this thing was going. And it became clear to us, clear to the Brits, clear to others, that Putin's main condition was buried in an annex to this document that they were working on. Mm-hmm. And it included limits on the precise kinds of weapon systems that Ukraine could have after the deal, such that Ukraine would basically be neutered as a military force. And there were no similar constraints on Russia. Russia wasn't required to pull back. Russia wasn't required to have a buffer zone from the Ukrainian border, wasn't required to have the same constraints on its military facing Ukraine. And so people inside Ukraine and people outside Ukraine started asking questions about whether this was a good deal. And it was at that point that it fell apart.
Volume.
Okay, if that was the main reason that they didn't decide to talk with Russia, to negotiate with it, that was so stupid, unbelievably stupid.
Yes, that was a cop-out. That was a delving reach into the agreement to find a paragraph and a sentence that she could pull out and wave in the air like a flag to a bull and say, this is why we did it. The real thing that Putin was worried about, and there's no question in my mind about this from talking with literally dozens of people who know more about it than I do, but I do know enough about the previous circumstances to say that they're right. He was very, very concerned about those weapon systems that were promised to Ukraine that represented the United States of America putting a nuclear capability on the very easternmost borders of Ukraine. I forget the exact nautical mileage, but it wasn't much. It was about 585 nautical miles or something like that from the center of Moscow. You're talking about INF range, no problem whatsoever with big warheads. And you're talking about ballistic missile carriers that can be converted in 24 hours into missile launchers for nuclear warhead missiles. That was Putin's grief. That was his real concern, was that not Ukraine was going to put them there, but the United States was going to put them there. just as it was talking about putting them in other countries that had previously been either neutral or in the Warsaw Pact that now were being speedily incorporated in NATO. And he got really, really concerned. Look at a map. Any military guy can look at a map and tell you, if we go to Georgia, he'll be very concerned. If we go to Ukraine, he'll be even more concerned. What did he do in Georgia? He showed his concern. He showed his concern with military force. We didn't take the lesson. We didn't take the hint. We went over and started doing the same thing in Ukraine. And I understand now, idiocy of idiocies, we're back in Georgia trying to foment another movement in Georgia and to tell the Georgians that if they do this and do that, they can not only be EU members, but they can also be NATO members. We're still at it. We're still doing these stupid things. And the idea that he won't do something in Georgia if we do that is crazy. He could have marched on Tbilisi. He could have taken Georgia. I had two people who were in the Ministry of Defense in Tbilisi at that time. They'd been there for a long time. One had been there 8 years and one had been there 6 years. And they told me that had he come, had he just said, I'm coming to Tbilisi and I'm going to take your whole country, he could have done it. There would have been very little the Georgians could have done. And I'm not so sure we'd have done anything either. We probably would have backed out as we did in Hungary and we did in Czechoslovakia when the Soviets did it. And we'd have said, Tbilisi, sorry, we got you in trouble and we're not going to be able to get you out. Well, we got Ukraine in trouble and we're not getting them out. They're still in trouble. They're still in big trouble. They could lose a whole lot more. I don't think they will if they're sane. As I said, if we can get this going, they won't lose any more than the occupied area that Russia has right now, which is all Putin wants, because he's seen the duplicity of NATO, the duplicity of Washington and London, and ultimately the duplicity of Kyiv, and he's not willing to accept that anymore. She reminds me of Bill Clinton trying to get out of his things, you know, to include Monica Lewinsky. I did not have sex with that woman.
Just to wrap up this session, Larry, we've learned that Saudi Arabia is talking about they're open to have petro yuan, and instead of petrodollar, now petro yuan, just to be linked with China. And here comes the question right now, whoever is going to be the president of the United States, we have a presidential debate tonight. And do you think that they're going to go the more aggressive way to deal with China, or they would decide to, because we understand that behind the scene, there has to be a group of people who are thinking about the foreign policy of the United States. I'm talking about those people. Are they considering to find a better solution instead of going to war with China, going to war in Taiwan, and putting an end to these two conflicts in the Middle East? And because we know what's going on in the Middle East, it's related to what Saudi Arabia is doing. They're not happy with what's going on in Gaza.
No, they're not at all. And I suspect at the end of the day, if there's any constancy to the royal family in Riyadh, it is the constancy of their own power. And it is the constancy of the family and of Saudi Arabia as Saudi Arabia, not Arabia, but Saudi Arabia. And so they will do whatever's necessary to preserve that. And the handwriting is on the wall. You know, the old Persian poet who said, moving finger writes and having writ moves on. Well, the moving finger is writing our downfall, the dollar's downfall, and moving on. And the Saudis are not going to be caught holding the bag when that happens. So they are going to be making bets on other possibilities, and they're going to be making them increasingly and more frequently. And I think this Gaza conflict has convinced them of something that they were thinking hard about before it started. And that was the unreliability and the deceitfulness of Washington. The same thing, incidentally, that Putin has concluded. And I think Xi Jinping is close to concluding. And I think Erdogan has concluded. So you understand what I say when the empire is in trouble. They are in trouble.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Sure. Great pleasure to talk with you.
Sure. Take care of yourself.
Take care.
See if I can.